Welcome to Whiskey Shenanigans. I'm your host, Randy Warren. Whiskey Shenanigans, where we help our listeners experience the world of whiskey, every aspect of life, as if it was accompanied by a glass of bourbon. The sports world on whiskey. Basically every part of life on whiskey. Whiskey Shenanigans is about getting exclusive interviews from Bourbon Row in Kentucky, where we can learn about the secrets that make our favorite bourbons unique. We will get inside the hearts and minds of many distillers and help you understand what and how they are achieving it. Whiskey Shenanigans is about going beyond boring podcasts featuring just tastings. Heck, what do you get out of that anyway? It's about bringing on guests and experiencing the entire world through whiskey. But be warned, if you're diving in and you want to participate in these riveting discussions, you will need to grab a glass or a dram and be prepared to be entertained. Hello again, Whiskey Shenanigans fans. We are very excited today to bring you an episode featuring Bullet Bourbon, the Frontier Whiskey. And with us today is Nathan Burkhead from Bullet. He is the maturation and warehousing manager at Diageo, which owns Bullet. So where are you at, Nathan? Are you in Kentucky?
Yeah, so I'm out of Shelbyville, Kentucky, at the trademark Bullet plant, so the one that hosts our visitor center. So my main office is here as it sits right now.
Fantastic. And we're also being joined by Sarah. How you doing, Sarah?
Good, how are you? I'll go off camera because when it's me,
we are very excited to get started, Sarah. This is awesome. Okay, great. So Nathan, you are the maturation and warehousing manager. So let's just start with that. What does that mean? What do you do?
So put it in a nutshell, I manage any barrels incoming and any barrels outgoing. I also handle our filling and dumping processes. So I work directly with our master blenders, our distillation, our master distiller. I work directly with them. So I consider them my customers is the easiest way to put it. So my job is to keep the tanks empty so the still can keep running. You know, we have a 365-day still here, so it never shuts off. So my job is to make sure that Courtney, our master distiller's tanks stay empty so she can keep pushing liquid. And I also support the bottling end of business. So I'm also dumping different blends and different liquid for our bottling sites, mainly out of Plainfield. And a couple other sites that we have within our network. So, in the biggest nutshell, basically I am just putting liquid in barrels and dumping liquid out of barrels and waiting for them to age and be to the perfect clogging that we like. So that's the easiest way to put it. So,
you must be working day to day with pretty closely with the guys that are tasting it. And, you know, they're saying this barrel's ready or that barrel's ready or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, every year we do survey sampling. So I'll pull thousands of samples for our master blenders and, you know, those guys will taste and, you know, give it the quality score they deem it. And then from there, they create the blend or what I call the Bible. From that Bible, I'll select the barrels that go into that blend and that picking. And then those barrels will get dumped and out comes, you know, Bold Orange Label or 10 year or, you know, our 95 rye or, you know, whatever it is that, you know, the bottling end is asking for at the time. So I'm kind of in the middle road of the business. I'm the front end and the back end at the same time. That's what makes this job kind of unique. You know, distillation is definitely the front end, but I'm also the front end of, you know, the beginning of that barrel's life. And I'm also the end of that barrel's life, you know, before it goes to be used for, you know, scotch or wherever, you know, that used barrel goes. So, yeah, it's a pretty interesting place to be, I'll be honest. So, you know, you're always busy.
Spend a lot of time in rick houses or?
So, you know, Diageo has kind of predominantly shifted to stack housing. I don't know if you've ever been in a stack house. It's a pretty mind-blowing thing the first time you walk in it. I came from rick housing in my prior career. So when I came, my first time I walked in a stack house, it was the city of barrels, as I like to call it. And it's just, it's overwhelming almost the first time you walk in. You know, those houses house almost 55,000 barrels. And it's just a lot to look at first. So, you know, it's pretty cool. But no, predominantly stack housing, which is, it tends to see, I think, where the industry is headed. And it's, you know, it's a safer place to be. And you can also do the work of, you know, it takes on a rick team or a ricker team, you know, 12 to 18 guys, depending on how many barrels you're pulling. And I can do it with four. So, you know, that alone is huge. And none of my guys are manhandling barrels unless something's gone, you know, drastically wrong. So from a safety aspect, you know, I take pride in knowing these guys, you know, everything's done with machinery and, you know, they get to go home at the end of the day, you know, the biggest thing we're all trying to do. So, you know, on that end, it's
great. I think a lot of us have seen rick houses, but maybe not too many have seen stack houses. What's it look like inside there?
So when you walk in a stack house, think of a giant warehouse style building. They are one story. And then these barrels are stacked on six barrels of pallet, and they're 36 barrels tall and they're 15 barrels deep. So it's 500, it's simple math, 540 barrels a row, and there's 107 rows. So think of the, I just call it a city, you know, barrels about 36 to 40 feet high on each side, straight down the aisleway. So it's, like I said, it's a little overwhelming first time you go up because you're looking 40 feet up in the air at barrels, and they're, you know, I forget the length of a warehouse, but, you know, several hundred yards worth of, you know, a building of barrels. So it's a pretty cool place. You know, I came from rick housing, where you walk in rick housing, you know, that's traditional, that's the historic way of barreling. So you walk in, it's the old feel, and, you know, stack housing almost feels futuristic. And when you walk into, it's real clean floors, it's real tidy, it's nice. And it's not, when you think bourbon, it's not what you think, because everybody's been in a rick house and everybody's been through all the tours in Kentucky. And you walk in a stack house and you're like, well, this is supposed to be dirty and it's just not the way it is. You know, it's a different way of doing it. So a lot more controlled way of doing things compared to rick housing, as far as like when it comes to the maturing end. You have something called cook-off when you look at rick housing. So your top end floor has, you know, what you call your honey barrels, where with stack housing, you kind of get that fluctuation more evenly. So we're getting a more even and more stand put product at the end of it. That makes sense. So like we're getting the same thing at the end. So in 7 years, we're able to predict that product a little bit better than we were in rick housing. So,
and do you have to move them around in order to get that consistency, or do they just stay in one spot?
No. So barrel cycling, as they call it, you know, in rick housing, where they'll rotate their barrels from the top floor to the bottom floor, and in stack housing, you do not have to do that. So that is a huge advantage. It's a huge logistical move. Anytime you move any barrel, whether it's rick housing or stack housing. So not having to do that is, you know, a big deal. You know, where those barrels sit is where they're going to sit until they age out or we deem them perfect. And then at that point, we pull them and dump them. So it's definitely a huge help, you know, from the logistical end of the business. So,
and when did you begin with Bullet?
So I've been with Bullet roughly going on 4 years. I've been in the industry almost 11 years. I came from Jim Beam. So I got my start. I started a distillery called Kentucky Artisan Distillery. Whiskey Row was the brand. I don't know where they are now. I think Jefferson Reserve bought them out, but that's who it was when I worked for them. So that's where I started as far as the industry goes. And then I moved to Beam and then now Diageo. So.
And how did you land this job? What did you have to say? what was the key phrase? What was the word?
You know, I'm from Kentucky. I'm a native to Kentucky. I got away from Kentucky a little bit when I joined the military and then came back. But, you know, I hate to say it's in your blood, but, you know, it's something you love to do. You know, I love bourbon. I love the idea behind it. I love the historicness of it. And being in this state, it's a huge pride thing. You can't go 2 miles down the street without seeing a distillery. If you haven't been to Kentucky, they're everywhere. So, you know, you just grow up around it. And it was something I always had interest in. And then I, you know, like I said, I got my feet wet at Kentucky Artisan and then moved to Jim Beam. And I, you know, I was on the bottling end of Jim Beam. So, you know, I sat there for almost roughly 7 to 8 years. And then Diageo called and it was a better opportunity. And, you know, I guess I just weaseled my way in here somehow. But, you know, it's been a rewarding career. It's a different industry. It's not as cut and dry as other industries go, you know, like beverage industry. It's got a lot of what I call gray area in it, and it's a really cool place to be. So
yeah, a lot of art in this science.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of art and a lot of tradition. Yeah. You know, and both correspond pretty well. So
what did your family say about the move? Are you married? You got parents in the area?
Yeah. Yeah. So I've got an 8-year-old little girl and I am married. I live in central Kentucky. So I live in the heart of bourbon country. I'm right outside Bardstown, Kentucky, which is considered, you know, the city of bourbon. My wife actually worked in the industry prior. She worked out of Trace, so she was already familiar with it.
Yeah.
And she since you know, owns her own business now. So she has left the industry. But, you know, I came from a pretty strong Christian upbringing. So I kind of went left wing when it came to bourbon. But, you know, they're supportive.
That's funny. Yeah. So they were excited. They were like, oh, this is great, Nathan. Fantastic. Congratulations on the move. Right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, every holiday and Christmas and, you know, I get asked, oh, where's my bottles? You know, where's my, you know, and I'll give Diageo credit. You know, they do a lot of give outs for their employees. So, you know, I've got a pretty decent bourbon collection at this point. One by my own bringing and, you know, other by just, you know, getting Christmas presents from Diageo. So
tell me about a time maybe when you're like walking through this warehouse and you're like, oh, wow. And you thought, man, I can't believe how cool this is. This is a really special place. Maybe it was like the smell of it or a sound or something that made you just go, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is awesome.
I would touch base when I first got kind of into warehousing. The sheer size of the warehousing is kind of remarkable in itself. The first time I walked in the stack house, I kind of touched base with it earlier. It's just, I guess you just don't realize, you know, I heard an interesting fact not too long ago. I think Kentucky houses like 17.1 million barrels of bourbon. And in those under our umbrella alone, we're a million of that. So when you walk in these houses, it's crazy to me because I look at all these and you're like, where is all this going? You know, and obviously we're an international company. There are, you know, millions of people, billions of people in the world. So, that, you know, there's a mouth to give it to. But it's just the amount of liquid, the amount of just sure size that Diageo in itself and, you know, other industries as well, you know, other players in the industry as well. It's just crazy. You know, like I said, you go down Kentucky and you just see distillery after distillery after distillery, and there's so many taste notes and so many different brands that just, it'll overwhelm you, you know, it'll kind of put you there. And so, you know, it's just crazy, you know, and being warehousing is a little unique because, you know, you get to see the back end of the business. You get to see the dirty warehousing, you know, and these barrels get put up and they come out 7-10 years later. And, you know, you get to see the coolness factor. You know, when I've dumping a 10-12 year old and, you know, here's a whole barrel of it compared to, you know, just seeing it on the shelf and you're like, it's a little bitty bottle. I'm seeing thousands and thousands of proof gallons, you know, being shipped. So it's a different experience for sure.
That is very, very cool. So Bullet, I would say I've been to your distillery, your you know, your walkthrough, your visitor center, and I've been to a bunch of them. And I would say you guys are different. So how do we put our finger on that? What makes Bullet different and unique?
I think Bullet and its high rye in general is what makes it more unique than other bourbons. Bullet's a very rye front where a lot of bourbons are corn front. That's a historical thing. A lot of bourbons are corn front just from their traditional ways. But Bullet having that high rye just gives it that spicier note that I think a lot of people seek for. Bullet itself also is also an innovative pusher. The biggest change I saw, and I won't talk a bit of any other industries or any other brands, but was Bullet pushes for innovation hard. When I first walked here, the biggest ask for me was find a better way to do it. You know, tradition is great and tradition is what drove this industry to where it is. But, you know, it's 2026 and we are pushing to how do we make this industry sustainable for the next 100 years so that our grandchildren and grandchildren, you know, enjoy the same bourbon that. But, you know, the old saying, it's not your grandfather's bourbon anymore is true. You know, it's technologically advanced. The way we do things is in precision. It's not on guessing. The way we batch, you know, Diageo, and if you've been through our tour, I mean, down to our HMI systems and how technology advanced our site alone is, you know, it's one of the most technologically advanced distilleries in the U.S. It's you know, it's just different. You know, we're not wearing coveralls and batching in a back creek anymore that, you know, I'm sure my great grandfather was doing. You know, we're batching at huge quantities and, you know, shipping in precision. So, you know, I have a really great team here. I work for some really great people and our master distiller, she's also, you know, incredible what she does. And I'm also very young to be in the position I am. And that's something Diageo doesn't hold up. You know, our master distiller is actually younger than me. And, you know, they're pushing that innovation and allowing the next generation to step in and, you know, trademark their place in this, you know. A lot of other brands are, you know, they have their 70-80 year old, you know, men that have been doing this and their grandfather did it and their grandfather. And, you know, it's kind of an honor to step in and have my place in history, as you could say. So
that's very cool. And I just want to highlight for our listeners, you know, there's no doubt when you go and visit a whole bunch of distilleries in Kentucky and you walk into Diageo or you walk into Bulleit in this case, it's like walking into a control room. It is very high tech. It's not at all like, you know, so many others, you know, that I've walked into, and it's very unique and very cool. And I imagine it, part of that is, I mean, it's designed for innovation, but it's also, you know, the innovation is designed towards producing a consistent product.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like I spoke to, you know, even down to stack housing, the way we're storing our barrels, you know, taking that broad approach to trying something different. You know, barrels have been on their side for hundreds and hundreds of years. So even the idea to turn them upright and put your bunghole at the top and, you know, take that initiative, Diageo does an incredible way of doing. And Bulleit in itself, the Bulleit brand in itself, you know, I speak Diageo as an umbrella, but I belong to Bulleit in that umbrella. Yeah, you know, like you said, you walk into a control room and it looks more like a gas refinery than it does a distillery, because you walk in and there's 18 screens and, you know, it's everything from the still to the mash container to the dump back tanks to your tank farm. You know, it's all corresponding. It's, and, you know, 98% of it's automated. So, you know, our guys, you know, you're taking the human approach into it, but you're taking the human out of it as well to get that consistency every single time. You know, like I said, you know, we got a really great team specifically here at Shelbyville and, you know, also Lebanon, our sister site. You know, there's a lot of minds that go into this every single day. A lot of, you know, it takes a lot, but, you know, it to get it done at this level is what you have to do. So
is Bulleit working on any, I mean, it's kind of a, I don't know whether it's a new thing or not, but maybe in the last 10 or 15 years, this idea of finishing techniques, something happening in that realm of the world?
Yeah. So coming from the warehousing end, I get faced with a lot of, I'll speak to what I can speak to. I get faced with a lot of innovation projects. I work directly with innovation out of Illinois. And I'll say that they're always pushing the envelope. They're always asking, let's try this, let's try this, let's age a cask in this, or, you know, let's try something. So yeah, to answer your point, absolutely. To give you much more than that, I'd probably get my hand slapped and get in trouble. So I will say I'll give you what I can with that.
I think I saw on the website there were a couple of experimental bottles or experimental, you know, whiskeys, you know, out there. That'd be pretty interesting.
Yeah, so the blenders are all, like I said, they're always pushing out of Tullahoma as well. We have really, really incredible blenders. Our master blenders are, I don't know how they do it, to be honest with you. They're really good at what they do. So we did an orphan barrel program and a couple other things like that that really helped drive that. You know, they were just different liquids, different tastes, different aspects of, you know, our broad portfolio of, you know, like I said, we house almost 1.1 million barrels within just the two plants. And, you know, that alone is crazy, the amount of different taste and ability they can do. But yeah, to answer your point, yeah, I feel like we're always chasing something. I feel like I'm every morning I walk in here, I'm getting an email saying, hey, can I get a sample request of, you know, this or this so we can push this? And, you know, it's pretty cool. Like I said, it's different from where I came from in the sense of I feel like Diageo is always trying to put something new in front of the customer and put something, you know, a different taste, a different element, because bourbon itself is always evolving and has to evolve. Like I said, bourbon, what it was 60 years ago to what it is now, it's just a different generation of people coming up and a different generation of drinkers. You know, the way my grandfather drank and the lack thereof and the way that, you know, a 20-year-old drinks now are just two different ways and two different things. You know, people want those different flavor notes. They want those cocktail experiences that, you know, we necessarily didn't want back in our day, but, you know, it's the ask of the industry now is, you know, our old fashioned product is incredible. I don't know if you had the whiskey sour, it's incredible. You know, like we have all these new brands coming out that are really good. Partially because Bulleit takes a stance on good product when we dump and age. So, but yeah, basic experience on that.
Yeah. And so the mash bills, I imagine you've got the Bulleit. I'm looking at the bottle right here. That's why I keep looking over there. I'm looking at the bottle. I got this bottle. Yeah. I got the lid off so I could get a really nice smell of that. And the Bulleit bourbon has one mash bill. The Bulleit rye is going to have a very different mash bill, right? And the American single malt is going to have another very different mash bill. I mean, the Bullet Bourbon's going to have corn, but it's still a high rye bourbon, right? It means there's a pretty decent percentage of rye in that bourbon.
Yeah, correct. So like when you look at our high rye and you look at our 95 rye and, you know, it's a 95% rye, or you're looking at our high rye, even our high rye bourbon is still a higher rye. Down to our single malt, you know, I'm not the master distiller here, so I won't speak on too much science that isn't my realm. But even from the dumping end, you know, I look at the way the blends work. Even down to our 10-year, we have an incredible 10-year. I don't, that is my, if I could speak to a brand, the 10-year here is incredible. Bullet does a really, really good job on the 10-year, partially because they put a lot of really good liquid into it, and it makes a really nice flavor. I don't know if you've tried the 10-year yourself, but if I had to trademark my favorite, that would be my favorite.
The 10-year rye?
Is that what you're referring? The 10-year rye? Well, no, I'm referring to the 10-year bourbon. Yeah, the 10-year rye is also really well. That's a newer, we actually just relaunched that out, so that was a pretty cool launch as well. So
yeah, I was trying that this weekend and absolutely was stunned at how really, really good it is. I was like, well, I wouldn't consider myself a big rye guy. Like, oh yeah, I gotta have a rye all the time. Usually I reach for a bourbon, not a rye. And but then, you know, wow, that is really good. But we'll get to that later. How many barrels do you guys produce a year anyway? It's a big operation, right?
Yeah, so roughly 50 to 60,000 barrels are produced a year. Our still runs about 55 GPM, so that's gallons per minute for your listeners. So, but our sister still, just to put in crazy perspective, they can go all the way up to 150 GPM. So their still is actually way bigger than ours. So yeah, it's a pretty big operation. So roughly 55,000 to 60,000 barrels a year. Yeah. So if you put that in perspective, it's essentially filling a warehouse a year, a warehouse and a little bit more. But we're also dumping almost the same perspective, you know, in that realm. So we're almost dumping, you know, 55 to 60,000. So as much new is coming in, old is coming out. So, right. You know, to put in perspective. So
it seems like industry's experienced a little bit of slowdown maybe or whatever. Do you see that at all in your end?
From my end, no. I feel like I've gotten busier. But yeah, you know, it's no secret where the industry is sitting at the moment. But from my industry, I feel like my guys are probably mad because I'm pushing them to their limits at this point. So, but no, you know, I haven't really seen a slowdown on my end. You know, we're still pushing a lot of liquid. You know, also being international, we're always, you know, I came from Beam as well, who's also, or Suntory now, who's also international. You know, you're always pushing a lot of liquid and you're always, I don't feel like we ever slow down. You know, I feel like the industry in itself, as long as I've been in it, has been on the gas for a hot minute.
Yep.
So
any idea what the budget is for all of this?
No, I don't handle that. I don't cut those checks. I can promise you that.
I'll ask you a rebellious question. What is the most rebellious or different approach that you've seen done with whiskey or something that's not, you know, according to tradition? Would you say it's the rye, or would you say it the automation that Bullet's doing? What would you say that you're doing that's the most kind of breaking of tradition?
I would say Bullet got its trademark from its rye. Bullet got itself on the map from being a high rye. Having tried probably hundreds of bourbon. It sounds like I'm not that old, but hundreds and hundreds of bourbons that I've tried. It's just a different note. You know, having that spicy note at the back end, but it's not overpowering. So if you ever tried a rye, it's there, but it's not overpowering. I've had other ryes in the past and, you know, it's almost too much for me. I like a smoother palate. I like something when I drink it, it's smooth. You know, you want that Kentucky burn on the back end, but you don't want to be coughing up a lung because you know, took too much down. So I think the biggest thing for Bullet in itself is their ability to kind of take a left wing of what traditional bourbon is. I think we've, you know, if you look at our umbrella across just out, even outside of Bullet, the Bullet 10, the Rye 10, you know, there's not a lot of older aged ryes out there. You know, it's just different. I don't know how another way to explain it because I've been in the industry long enough to see the difference. It's just a different approach that they take that I think is a little rebellious. You know, there's a lot of traditional ways, and I've worked in traditional, you know, I worked for one of the bigger dogs in this industry. And they're really sought on tradition, and tradition is great, and they make, you know, great products from it. But I think being able to step out of that realm and speak to different people in different, you know, parts of the world is what's going to drive this industry another 100 years. You know, like I said, it's not your grandfather's bourbon anymore because it's different. It has to be.
Yeah. So, you know, which one are you reaching for when you're you're kicking back on a Friday afternoon? Let's see. Today's only Monday, right?
Yeah, it's just Monday. So,
but which one are you reaching for on a Friday afternoon?
I'm going to have to go our Bullet 10 bourbon. I think it's an incredible for the price point, for what it is, for what, you know, I happen to know what's in it as well. It is a 10 out of 10 for me. And you know, I like you said, I'm a more of a smooth palate drinker, and it's very smooth. If you're new to bourbon, it's a good influx into bourbon because it provides a lot, you know, for the price point that it's at, you know. And then obviously you can get into your deep sockets and then get into the aftermarket, and you get into, you know, real expensive stuff but you know, it's really good. I take a lot of pride in it because, you know, yeah, my team is the one that dumps that bourbon. So,
that's right.
You know, that's what I'm going for. If I had to pick one that I would go to over and over and over again, it would be Bullet 10, our bourbon. So,
and if you're pouring drinks for a couple of friends and having a conversation, do you ever get any interesting conversations over those bourbons?
I think everybody always, you know, the question I get asked the most is, what's the oldest bourbon I've, you know, what's the oldest barrel you've got? And, you know, the classic questions of how many barrels do you all sit on, or, you know, do you get to drink straight from the barrel? You know, the classic questions that everybody asks who's not in the industry. Yeah. Do you, you know, hold the barrel up and get right under like a water fountain? So, you know, your typical questions I get, but, you know, I lost my train of thought for 2 seconds, but
interesting conversations that you've had with your friends. Yeah,
you know, and coming from Kentucky, you know, everybody's aware of the industry. There is positive remarks and negative remarks I get on the industry. You know, being so many distilleries, you know, you're always going to find some negativity in there somewhere. But for the most part, you know, Kentucky was built on the back of this industry. There is several industries in Kentucky, but being very rural that it is, the bourbon industry has done a lot for the state, in my opinion. That is strictly my opinion. So, you know,
yeah. And what do people who aren't as familiar, like maybe not from Kentucky, what do they ask you? Like, what are they interested? Like, they may not know everything that's going on, and they don't know, they don't have all the background that you have, and they might just ask you dumb questions. I don't know. But like, what are some of the most common things that people want to know?
I think the biggest thing people, you know, I always get the joking ask of, where's my bottle? Or, you know, I've gone out of state with my wife and we travel across country. And, you know, one of the biggest things I get asked is, oh, do you have any bourbon in the car? You know, anything like that. And there's a misconception in the bourbon industry, especially I get out of state, that it's kind of a funny misconception, but people still think we're wearing coveralls and, you know, out here doing stuff out of a creek. And the industry is just not that. If you've been to Kentucky, it is, you know, it is a very big industry, and the misconception outside of it is, oh, you know, and there's some historicalness of to that point. But if you go to, you know, Buffalo Trace or Bullet or, you know, Jim Beam, or you go to any of these bigger distilleries in the state of Kentucky, it's just gone a long way from where it was. And that's the biggest question I get asked is, oh, you know, you walk into these stores and you've been here and you see the sheer size of these fermenters, and, you know, it's just not what it was 150 years ago to what it was. So I think it's the biggest misconception, the biggest ask, or what you call dumb question is, oh, are you all still doing this? Or, you know, we're not.
No, we've come a long way since then, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, the bourbon has definitely shaped American culture, but it's also shaped Kentucky culture. Any insights into like how that, what do you think about that?
Yeah. So, like I said, you know, when I say in my blood, you know, I had family members that were whiskey runners, you know, 100 so years ago, during Prohibition. So, you know, it's shaped to what Kentucky is. There's a lot of historicness in Kentucky. Like I said, I've been in warehouses that are condemned. I was in warehousing years ago that, you know, women from the 1940s, when the men went off to war, they worked in the warehousing. So their names were signed on the third floor. It's just a lot of historical stuff within Kentucky that has made it to where it is. And, you know, if you've ever been to Kentucky Derby, the bourbon industry kind of built that race up to what it is. It's, you know, you can't think of Kentucky without bourbon. As good and bad as that is, you know, every time you talk to somebody, you say I'm from Kentucky, they're saying, oh, you're bourbon. That's their immediate go-to. But, you know, yeah, you can't.
Bourbon and horses.
Yeah, it's horse country and bourbon. That's what we're doing down here. So,
and man, is it beautiful. I mean, that's the other thing people don't know about Kentucky is just what a beautiful state it is. I mean, that's why the horses are there. And that's why you make bourbon there with the water and the, you know, the limestone. It's just it's a beautiful state and it's lush.
Yeah, I tell everybody I love Louisville and I love Lexington, but if you get about 15, 20 minutes outside of either one, you get into the back country of Kentucky. And to your point, the rolling hills, you know, I grew up here, so I'm very biased to it. I have got to live and be in different states, but this is home. So to your point, I live in central Kentucky, which is, you know, bourbon land in the way, you know, that's where bourbon came from. And it is beautiful. You go around. I can't even explain it. It's something you have to experience yourself. You got the Red River Gorge, which is a really incredible place to visit. You know, it's worth a trip, you know, to anybody who's never been. So I say that.
If you could bring our listeners along with you on a day of work. I don't know. Are you wearing boots to work?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not I'm not an office. I wish I was an office worker, but not the case.
So we're walking in your boots, right? And, you know, what are the three things you want to show me, I mean, about this whole situation?
Yeah, like I said, the first thing, you know, if you've ever gotten a witness, and I don't know all tours get to go to it, but the filling and dumping operation of what my guys do is an incredible thing to witness. You can YouTube anything, but it's just really cool to watch a barrel get emptied and, you know, watch a barrel get filled and just the sheer size of what we're doing. That alone is really cool. Other than that, you know, I'd speak to warehousing, walking into a stack house or walking into a rick house or any warehouse you walk into, the historicalness of it, the size of it, the amount of barrels. It's something, in my opinion, is something to see. It's something you walk in and, you know, I've given several tours on site and, you know, every time somebody walks in, like, oh, wow. And then the sheer smell, if I could describe the smell of a stack house, it's a lot stronger than a rick house. There's a misconception. Rick houses actually fluctuate their ethanol vapor a little bit better than a stack house does. A stack house actually keeps that ethanol vapor down, which we get into the maturing side, actually helps the maturing side. But it's very strong. You walk in, it's like hitting a wall. So if you walk into one, it's like, oh, wow. You know, but, you know, and other than that, it's, you know, just the people. The people aboard are incredible. I've really enjoyed time. I always thought I would never enjoy work, and I really love what I do here. I love the people here. I have an incredible team underneath me and a team above me. I've had bad days. Don't get me wrong. Everybody has bad days at work, but, you know, for the most part, you know, the people here, you know, I've got a bunch of local boys that work for me, a bunch of local Kentucky natives that work for me. And, you know, I've got every walk of life that works for me. So it's really cool to see. And like I said, Bullet takes a strong suit on all walks of life. So if you walked in our office, there's so many different people, so many different cultures, so many different, it's just all one. And it makes me feel like home because that's what the military was to me. You know, the military is all walks of life walking into one. And that's really how I feel Bullet's been for me specifically, you know, so.
Yeah. That's amazing. So the pundits might think that whiskey is in decline and all that sort of stuff, but maybe younger generations aren't drinking as much. Maybe they're health conscious. Maybe they're just smoking weed. I don't know what they're doing, but you know, I'm not of the younger generation anymore, unfortunately. Bummer. But you know, you think whiskey is about to make a big comeback?
I think there's a different ask. You know, back then it was neat, you know, no ice, and that's what was driven. And that's what, you know, and there, you'll always have your traditional whiskey lovers and your bourbon lovers. You'll always have those guys that live and die and give it to me neat and give it to, you know, you're going to have that. But I think there's a different ask from the people that, you know, we're trying to attest to, you know, like I said, Bulletin in itself, you know, our pre-mades, our old fashions, our whiskey sours, You know, and we're always pushing to go to that next step. I think people enjoy bourbon, but they want to enjoy bourbon in different ways. And what the one thing that Bullet's done incredible well is, you know, me personally, I've toured hundreds of bartenders because bartenders alone have asked a lot from Bullet. You know, they want to see these notes. They want to see these spices so that they're able to mix that drink better in more drinks. I'm not a bartender myself. You know, there's no way I could do that. I'm lucky to get Sprite and whiskey together and make it good. But, you know, I think the industry in its whole has to change a little bit. The days of neat bourbon, although are always going to be there, I think there's a different ask coming. And I think it's going to be delivered. I've seen this industry come up and down over the past 11 years, and I don't see it staying down or up. It's going to fluctuate like any other industry. I don't think anybody stays on top all the time. So, you know, that's part of it.
I can't imagine it's not going to make a huge comeback. I think just because people were at home during COVID and they probably drank more during COVID. Yeah. So what, you know, so there's a little downturn after that's all over and that's in the history. And it's like, but people love this product. It's an amazing product.
Oh, absolutely. COVID was COVID. COVID was a different time, different place. You know, I think every industry, even outside our industry, saw just random numbers that, you know, you can't base your entire product off, you know. But like you said, you know, we're coming off COVID. You know, it's been a few years, but I think we're finally seeing the monotone and the level out of what is reality and what is true. Like I said, you know, I don't see a lull of excitement in my office. You know, I don't see a lull of excitement within Diageo. I actually see an uptick a little bit. You know, I feel like we're pushing a little bit more than we were to try different things, to do different things, because I think you have to. I don't think you can stay stagnant forever because you're not appeasing, you know, you're not appeasing to, you know, everybody around you at that point. So,
right. Yeah. And I can relate to what you were saying before about people like to enjoy it in different ways. I like to enjoy it. I usually start with some neat and I smell it and taste it, try to get the full experience of the product. And then I'm like, okay, maybe I'll just put a little ice in it. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just put a little simple sugar in the bottom and then put a little of the liquid in on top. Mix it around. All right. Maybe then, you know, next time I'll get a drink and I'll put a little simple sugar in it and a little bit of bitters in it. Maybe some orange bitters, some walnut bitters, some, you know, Angostura bitters, absolutely. You know, whatever. Just try different ways and see what makes the product light up. It's fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think. Like I tell everybody, always try it neat. You know, try what you're having first, and then, you know, who cares what you put in at that point? You know,
that's right.
There's some loyalists out there will tell you, oh, absolutely don't. But if it makes it taste good to you and you like it that way, then absolutely. So you know, for me,
go ahead.
No, I was saying, you know, for me, I'll take Bullet 10, and you've always heard of a tequila sunrise. But if you take Bullet 10, and then you take orange juice and grenadine, I think it's really good. So
yeah,
you call it Kentucky Sunrise, if you will, but you know, it's same thing. So
yeah, Kentucky Sunrise. So our listeners also, they like to get to know our guests a little bit too. Like we want to know a little, we've learned a lot about Nathan. We learned a lot about what Nathan does and all that sort of stuff. But you know, some like questions for you, like, you know, if you're traveling and you walk into a bar, or maybe you get invited to a wedding in Arizona or something, and they don't have any Bullet. I mean, I can't imagine, because Bullet does an amazing job of distribution, but let's just say they don't have, just pretend they don't have any Bullet there. You know, what are you going to reach for? What are you going to ask for?
You know, for me personally, let me think about this question for a second.
First, you take a swing at the bartender.
Step one, you know, for me, I'm like I said, I'm rooted in Kentucky. I'm rooted in traditional bourbon. So I can appreciate one thing that this job has done well for me over 11 years is I can appreciate good bourbon. Although I'm biased to what we make, and I'm biased to, you know, the 10-year, like I spoke before, I can appreciate good handcrafted bourbon. I've had hundreds of different bourbons. I've had everything from ones you've probably never heard of unless you walk into a liquor store in Kentucky, and they're the smallest batch of distiller you can think of. And I've had the biggest of the players out there, and I can appreciate it. You know, so for me, I'm definitely going to grab a bourbon. Depends on what that's going to be. You know, it's hard to say for me. You know, I can appreciate any of it. I don't love all of it, but you know, I can appreciate any of it. So as long as I had a pretty traditional bourbon, I could probably grasp that and do that if I had to say.
I was at a wedding in Italy earlier this year, I guess it was. And, you know, I was like, oh no, I'm in Italy, man. I don't know if they drink bourbon here. You know, it's like, uh-oh, it's just going to be, you know, wine all the time and Aperol spritz and stuff like that that they drink over there. And I'm like, uh-oh. And then sure enough, I was able to find some Wild Turkey bourbon. It's like,
oh, there you go.
There's at least one. There's one out there that made it all the way to, you know, Tuscany, Italy. Thank heaven. I was so excited.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Just kind of start reaching at that point, you know, whatever you can find. So
whatever you can find. Well, that's awesome. But, anything I didn't ask you that I should have asked you? What do you think?
No, like I said, I advocate for the brand because the brand itself has helped me on a personal level. And, it's a really good company to work for. Diageo in itself is incredible. I've never had such a work-life balance in my life. I work with some incredible people and, you know, outside of the product we make, it's just a really good place to be. I tell everybody that because, you know, I'm not one to front anything and I'm not one to lie about anything. So, you know, I've worked for several brands and, you know, I speak very highly of Diageo and Bullet Shelley Villain itself. You know, it's a small, as big as we are, we're a small, you know, there's probably 30, 40 people on our site. So, you know, everybody knows everybody. So, and then our sister site as well is the same way. So
like a family. Like
I said, you know, yeah. And I hate to use the cliche comment that like family, but I mean, yeah. I'm with these people more than my own family. So, yeah. So they great. Have to be really. So,
yeah. And I mean, honestly, I can say, I told you before, I was so impressed with the 10-year rye. I was like, wow, that's, you know, usually the rye is going to be really spicy and uh-huh. with a little bite and everything like that. But it was really nicely mellowed out. You could taste the vanilla and, you know, the caramel in there. And it's like, wow. I mean, you get the floral notes and things like that, but you know, and you still got a little kick, got a little baking spice kick right there at the end.
Oh yeah, exactly. Really, like I said, really nice. I attest that to our team. You know, we have a really incredible team. You know, obviously I'm on the top, the front end of it, orchestrating logistics and all that. But, you know, we have incredible people that work here and there are a lot of passion all the way down to, you know, the man, you know, the janitor level, you know, people just love being here. It's funny. You asked how I got my start. When I started at Jim Beam, I was a general helper on third shift. So I actually cleaned bathrooms. And I worked my way up. So I have a good appreciation of all the way up there. So,
hey, we all, I don't know about everybody, but we all got our start doing that. I did too.
Oh, you know? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I just wanted in. So I took whatever I could get to get in
college. You know, I was like, I was working at a museum, cleaning bathrooms, sweeping floors, whatever, you know, and you get, then, you know, you just move up. You start at the bottom and you move up.
Yeah, I'll never forget. I was super excited when I first got my, I called an inspector, but I got to sit on a line and stare at bottles going by, and I thought I hit the jackpot. So, and then after a while, you're like, oh man, this isn't it either. So you have to slowly work where you're going. So,
yeah, but that's great. So you've landed in a great spot. Congratulations on that, Nathan, and congratulations to Bullet. This is great product. Highly recommend it. And I don't say that at the end of every episode. So, you know, you can be sure it's the real deal. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like I said, people alone, I think it's worth trying. If you're new to bourbon, I think it's worth trying. And if you're an experienced bourbon drinker, you're definitely going to appreciate the 10 years and the 12, you know, the 12 year rye and the, you know, a couple other things we have released and even down to our newer products, you know, and always keep on the lookout. Like I said, without saying it, there's always things coming. So, you know,
yep. Yeah. And I'm going to be looking for those experimental situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Try some of those too. I love to try new stuff. That's always fun. So thank you so much today for joining us, Nathan. It's really been a special treat to hear directly from Bullet, hear directly from you about what you're doing and how you're doing it. And it's a unique institution, what you guys are doing over there. It's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I appreciate you having me on. This is actually my first podcast experience, so I appreciate it. I'm not a talker. I'm the back end of the business. I'm the behind closed doors, so it's a little bit different.
Right.
To, get out there and talk.
No worries. No worries at all. That's great. It was a great interview, and I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Whiskey Shenanigans fans, it's time for the shenanigans portion of this episode. You know I like the NFL. Wearing my TJ Watt jersey today. Steelers were exciting, but we're going to hold off. We're not going to talk about that. Let's go down the list. Let's start at number three. The three most surprising things that happened in the NFL this week. Number three, the Rams completely melt down and lose to the Seahawks. Who are the Seahawks? Is this team any good? This brings up a broader question. There's a bunch of teams that have really good records this year. Denver, the Patriots, the Seahawks. These teams have not been good in a while. Is this an exciting thing? Is this a problem? Stay tuned and we'll find out. All right. So that is shocking. The Rams meltdown and the Seahawks and a bunch of like not that good teams have been winning. Now, you've heard me say it before that Indianapolis was a fraud. I think we're going to find out very quickly that some of these other teams that are number ones and number twos in the playoff race right now are also frauds. Keep in mind, these teams had easy schedules. When you win a Super Bowl or you come in second or you're, you know, one of the top teams the previous year, you get one of the hardest schedules the next year. When you stink, you get an easy schedule. You get to play other stinky teams so that somebody will emerge. Now, of course, you're going to have to play a good team from time to time, right? I mean, especially teams in your division, you can't avoid playing teams in your division. You can't avoid certain things. But there's three games right now every year that are totally up to the discretion of the NFL. And those three games, when you're a good team, up until now, you would have been playing Buffalo. You would have been playing the Chiefs. You would have been playing, you know, good football teams during that stretch of three games. Now you look at the teams that Denver played. They were not a good team last year. You look at the teams that the Patriots played. They were not a good team last year. Those three games were gimmies, especially because these are good teams, right? The Patriots are a good team. I think we all agree to that. They're good. Exactly how good are they, though? Are the Bears really good? Which leads me to my next most surprising thing. The number two most surprising thing that happened in the NFL last year. Not last year, last week. Drum roll, please. The Packers completely melt down to the Bears in the fourth quarter. The Bears. Who are the Bears? Caleb, is he really that good of a quarterback? Or is he just playing lights out right now? Hard to say, but boy, the Steelers really helped the Packers because the Bears now took the key position in that NFC North. And if the Detroit Lions had beaten the Steelers, that would have hurt the Packers. Packers are still in this thing. Detroit, sadly, almost sadly, is pretty much out of it. You know, on that note, part of like, we'll call it 2A or 2B, second most surprising thing, Jacksonville whoops Denver. Okay. This goes back to the previous point. Is Denver really that good? They win like 11 straight games. Okay. But is Jacksonville good? They're playing lights out. Trevor Lawrence is on fire. Did you see that? Four touchdowns. This guy is making them pay out there. So, I don't know. Who are these good teams? Jacksonville's a top team now. Denver's a top team. The Patriots are a top team. What happened to Buffalo, Kansas City? What happened to the Ravens? Oh, the poor Ravens.
they're struggling, and it makes me shed a tear. I'm so sad. Nobody likes to see anybody get hurt. But if there's somebody who's going to get hurt, might as well be Lamar. Might as well be Jordan Love. Don't love those guys. Ah, I mean, nobody wants to see anybody get hurt, but hey, the fact that Lamar gets hurt, hurts his back, and can't return to the game this week really sets the Steelers up pretty nicely. So if they lose, if the Baltimore Ravens lose this coming week and the Steelers win, even I don't even know if the Steelers have to win. If Baltimore loses, they're out and the Steelers win the division. If the Steelers win, it doesn't matter what Baltimore does. They win the division. So it's coming down to the wire, folks. 2 weeks left. But let's go to the number one most surprising thing in the NFL this past weekend. You're going to think I'm a homer, right? It's the Steelers again. Everybody's talking about this game. You know, the end of that game was so mind-blowing. There were so many mistakes made on both sides of the ball. So many mistakes made by coaches. It was a mind-blowing game. 2 minutes and 15 seconds left. 3rd and 8. Steelers are in easy field goal position. And they go into the shotgun to throw the ball. Wait a minute. Didn't Detroit only have one timeout left? Shouldn't the Steelers have run that ball no matter what? Even if they didn't get a yard, that would have caused either them to let it run down to the 2 minute warning or to have Detroit use up their last timeout. The Steelers didn't do that at all. So mistakes, coaching mistake, the play call was a mistake. And number two, then Aaron Rodgers makes a mistake. He's getting chased around the field. He throws it away. With 2 minutes and 9 seconds left, the clock stops. Incomplete pass. They didn't have to use the 2 minute warning. They didn't have to use a timeout. Detroit's like, thank you very much. Dumb. Okay. We're all human. We all make mistakes. Aaron made a mistake. All right. He made a mistake. Detroit gets the ball back. One of the first things that happens, I don't know if it was the first play or the second play of the drive, is they throw a ball to this guy on Detroit who I still don't know whether he caught it or not. It's definitely questionable. He landed on the ball. The ball was moving around, but you couldn't really see it. And I will say that the refs made the right decision. You couldn't really see it. So they couldn't overturn the call. Okay, hurts my Steelers. You just gave them like 20 yards, maybe. Whatever. Maybe he caught it. I don't know. Okay. And then the next thing, two more penalties on the Steelers. A personal foul tripping call. Correct call by the referee, by the way. Okay. And I think the last play, I don't even know what the other penalty was. Okay. Couple of penalties on the Steelers allowed the Detroit Lions to move all the way down the field. Those three plays in combination put Detroit from their own 35 to the Steelers' 35. And all Detroit had to do was move it into position to score, which they did. They moved it right down into position to score. Three decisions by the referees, all against the Steelers in a row. Now Detroit, and a good play by Detroit. And now Detroit is on the one with goal to go. Seconds left in the game, like 30 or 40 seconds left in the game. First and goal at the 1 yard line. And they start making mistakes. Okay. Now the guy picks one of the Steelers' defensive backs and is open for an easy touchdown. Well, why was it so easy? Because he illegal pick. Again, the refs got it right. Then the next thing that happens is Detroit causes I think it was a movement penalty, and they go back again. So now they're at the 16-yard line. It's like first and goal at the 16 or something like that, and they're running out of time. The very last play of the game turns into another referee decision. They throw the ball down the field. The guy picks the defensive back again, They don't catch. Well, no, he did catch it, didn't he? He did catch it. He was wide open. He did catch it. Okay. But they already threw the flag. So time is now, it doesn't matter. The rest of this play, everybody's freaking out because what happened in the rest of the play was after he caught it, he was about to get tackled. He laterals the ball to the quarterback and the quarterback scores. None of that matters. Once you commit a foul, like a holding call, you know, against one of your offensive linemen, the fact that you then score a touchdown is meaningless. Doesn't make any difference. You committed a foul, and in this particular case, time ran out. There was no time left. So it was over. The game was over. The referees took forever to come up with this decision. They stood around and talked and talked and talked. I think they were like, you know, having lunch out there or something. But they came up with the right decision. And I will say, for the first time in years, I would say this. The referees called that game pretty darn well. Pretty darn well. They did not make a mistake at the end of the game. Every call they made was 100% correct. The ones against the Steelers were 100% correct. The ones that helped the Steelers and were against Detroit were absolutely correct. Every call was 100% spot on. They absolutely nailed it. When do you ever hear anybody say that? Everybody complains about the referees. It's always the referee's fault. I think Troy Aikman said something like that. He's like, the referees gave that game to the Steelers. No, they did not. The referees were 100% correct in every call they made in the final minutes of that game. Now, the players, on the other hand, the players didn't do so well. They were messing up left and right. I mean, the Steelers, we already went over their mess ups. The Detroit Lions, we went over their mess ups. Very shocking. Coaching mess ups. All kinds of things were happening in that last fourth quarter. Let alone the fact that, you know, Boswell, probably one of the top one or two kickers in the entire NFL, misses a game-clinching 37-yard field goal with, you know, what was that, 3 minutes left in the game? Oh, my goodness. What a shocking ending. There was a lot of shocking things that go on. What do you guys think? Is Denver any good? Are the Patriots any good? Are any of these teams going anywhere? Or when they get up against the Bills in the playoffs, what happens then? They're going to get shellacked by the Buffalo Bills? Or they might even get beat by the Steelers. I mean, I'm pretty sure I looked this up earlier. Pretty sure the Steelers already beat the Patriots this year. So, you know, who knows? I mean, I think that's when everybody thought the Patriots stunk. But they don't. They're a good team. But are they really? They're not battle tested. They're not playoff tested. This team is all young. The coach is a relatively new coach, played for the Patriots, yada, yada, yada. Won a whole bunch of Super Bowls for the Patriots, yada, yada, yada. Who cares? Mike Vrabel, wah, 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 wah. Whatever. Bottom line here is that it's surprising that some of these teams are doing as well as they're doing. The Seahawks, shocking me. The Rams are the best team in that division. Come on. The Rams are the best team. I can't believe they lost to the Seahawks. That's mind-blowing. Jacksonville beats up on Denver. And how about Carolina? Carolina beats up on Tampa Bay and takes control of the NFC South. This stuff is crazy. This stuff is crazy, but it's a whole lot of fun to watch. And for once, you can't complain about the refs. I didn't see any egregious missed calls yesterday. I saw a bunch of stuff where you're like, they could have called holding on that. They could have called pass interference on that. They could have called, you know, offensive pass interference. But it wasn't horrible, right? It wasn't egregious. It wasn't like over the top. Like, oh, man, that's just terrible. How can the NFL let this go on? Which I've said a whole lot over the last couple of years. The NFL lets some terrible refereeing happen in this game. Not yesterday. Yesterday, give them props. They did it right. They called it right. They got it right. And the right teams won. The teams that were better won the games. Now it comes down to the last 2 weeks. And we'll see what happens. A lot of things could swap. Okay. Denver could, you know, could swap out. You know, Seattle could swap out with the Rams. The Steelers could swap out, and the Ravens could still make the playoffs after all this. Now Lamar is injured. Okay, it's probably not going to happen. But we got a game coming up, very important game coming up between the Packers and the Ravens. Jordan Love gets injured. Lamar gets injured. We got two injured quarterbacks. Maliki Willis, not Maliki, his name's Malik. Malik Willis, who played for Liberty University, is the backup quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. And you know what? That guy did great. If you're that guy, you're going, yeah, man, I deserve to start in this league. That was a phenomenal performance that he put on, coming in relief for Jordan Love. They didn't miss a beat. They still lost to the Bears. Ugh, how does that happen? Go Malik. Oh, yeah, go, baby. And we got to be rooting for him this week because he's going to be going up against the Ravens. And you know what? The Ravens' defense looks pretty bad. So, hey, with no Lamar, Lamar's their whole team, man. He's their whole team. And Green Bay looks like the better choice for that game with two injured quarterbacks that aren't going to be playing. So I'm thinking maybe Green Bay comes out with a victory. The Steelers going up against the Cleveland Browns. That looks like a Steelers victory to me. You never know. Oh, let us not forget that Miles, whatever his name is, for the Cleveland Browns is going to break the single season sack record. Come on. I'm so tired of that guy. You know, he's the only guy that's on their team that's any good. And yeah, I don't want him to break the record. I don't want him to break the record against the Steelers, and I don't want him to break the record in the last week of the season either. I think he got AFC Player of the Year a couple times. Undeserving. This year, if he breaks the record, he deserves it. And even if he doesn't, he still probably deserves it. He's got like 20, 21 sacks. So the guy's a beast. He's having a great year. You got to give him props for that. This is the year when he probably deserves it. And those previous years, TJ Watt deserved it. Totally. Aaron Donald stole one from TJ Watt. TJ Watt should have like four of them by now. Defensive Player of the Year. They didn't give it to TJ. Come on. I'm a homer. You know it. You know I'm a homer. Come on, Steelers. Whatever. Let's not blow this. Let's not mess this up. Tomlin didn't have a chance to do the Tomlin turtle yesterday either. Just saying. So, hey, it's going to be a big showdown the last couple games in the NFL. And it'll be fun to watch. So stay tuned. Let's have a good time. Let's watch some football, baby. How did it become Dueling Grounds?
So in the early 1800s, at an area right located on the border of Kentucky and Tennessee, which is where we sit, along the Cumberland Trace, which is now essentially I-65 going north, there was a little area right on the border that was known as Lincoln Pinch, and it was famous for hosting pistol duels. Over 40 documented duels happened there on the grounds at Lincoln Pinch, the most famous of which would have been Sam Houston. And then several others, and it probably wouldn't surprise you that most of the duels were between lawyers.
I assume Sam Houston won, but
yeah. And actually he did not. It was kind of considered a bit, it wasn't necessarily it was not the intention to kill your opponent. The intention was to draw first blood. As a matter of fact, if you were to kill your opponent outright, you could find yourself up on murder charges.